Mind and Matter podcast. I'm your host, Nick Jacomas, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Will De La Teague. Professor De La Teague is a neuroscientist whose lab is at the Monell Chemical Senses Center. I think he also has an appointment at the University of Pennsylvania, but his lab studies the neurobiology of eating. And in particular, they focus on how the sensation of internal stimuli within the body, especially meal-related cues from the gut, influences decisions around when, where, and how much to eat. So if you think about it, we're all familiar with the five classic senses: taste, smell, touch, sight, hearing. These are all forms of exteroception, sensing things that are happening outside the body. His research is really focused on interoception, the brain's ability to sense what's going on inside the body. And one of the things they focus on is the vagus nerve. It's one of the largest nerves, one of the largest bundles of neurons in the brain. It reaches down from the hindbrain and innervates pretty much all of the organs of the body: the stomach, the GI tract, the heart, the lungs, and so forth. And this is a nerve that is sensing what's going on in our organs. So we talked about that in the context of feeding behavior. So when you eat a meal, how is the vagus nerve sensing your stomach getting fuller? How is it sensing the particular nutrients that are in what you just ate while it's in the intestine? How does it detect, say, fats versus sugars? How is it able to sense different nutrients and send those signals back up to the brain? We talked about how the vagus nerve is hooked up with the dopamine reward system in the brain, how certain combinations of nutrients like fats and sugars together can be extra rewarding or extra addicting. We talked about that in the context of junk food and obesity and why we have things like an obesity epidemic. And so if you're interested in gut-brain communication, how what's going on in the gut is actually sensed by the brain, this is a really interesting episode for you. He's got a lab that's using a lot of modern sophisticated neuroscience techniques to really dissect these nerves in detail and figure out how they're working. We also, towards the end, talked about things like gut hormones, things like leptin or GLP-1 that send signals of hunger and satiety to the brain. We talked about things like Ozempic and the new GLP-1 agonist drugs that people are using to lose weight. We talked about how they worked, why they work the way they work, and whether or not there are any risks that people might want to keep in mind as they think about using these weight loss drugs. As always, keep in mind I have a Substack, mindandmatter.substack.com. You can go there, sign up for my free weekly newsletter, become a paid subscriber to gain early access to shows and access to show notes and things like that. And you can also share the podcast, you know, with your friends or family. That's actually one of the best ways to help me grow. Hey everyone, I want to take a minute to tell you about a really cool health monitoring device I've been using for several weeks. It's called Lumen, and it's a handheld, pocket-sized device with a sleek design. It measures CO2 levels in your breath, which allows their technology to determine the extent to which your body is burning fats versus carbohydrates. Lumen helps improve your metabolic flexibility, your body's efficiency in shifting between using fats and carbs. It improves your ability to burn fat, which decreases your hunger levels and makes your body less dependent on snacking, and it can increase your energy levels by helping you develop a high-functioning metabolism. I use this device in the morning, before bed, and after meals and workouts to track my metabolism. With just a couple weeks of use, I learned a lot about which foods were causing my body to burn mostly fat, mostly carbs, or both, as well as how long I need to fast each day to promote fat burning. Lumen is great for anyone looking to optimize their health for either weight loss or athletic performance. The easy-to-use app allows you to track your results together with what you're eating and how you're exercising, and it syncs with other devices like the Apple Watch. Click the link in the episode description to learn more and use the code MIND, M-I-N-D, in all capital letters to get $50 off your Lumen device today. This episode is supported in part by Athletic Greens. Their main product, AG1, is a comprehensive and convenient daily nutrition product containing 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients with less than 1 gram of sugar per serving, no nasty chemicals or artificial anything. It's gluten and dairy free and compatible with paleo, vegan, vegetarian, and ketogenic diets. AG1 is a quick and convenient way to supplement your diet to help ensure your body is getting the nutrients it needs. It comes in powder form, and you can mix it in water and drink it, or you can put it into a smoothie or a shake or something like that. I mix it into water and drink it with the first meal of each day, and it's super convenient. If you go to athleticgreens.com/mindandmatter, Athletic Greens will give you a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. Their vitamin D product comes in tincture form, so you just take one drop each day. A large fraction of the population is actually vitamin D deficient, especially in winter months when we get less sun exposure, and vitamin D is super important for the proper function of the immune system and for a variety of other things. And there's even evidence indicating that vitamin D deficiency is correlated with more severe cases of COVID-19 in those who get infected. Every time I go into the doctor each year for a checkup, I'm always told that vitamin D deficiency is very common and I should be supplementing on a daily basis. So visit athleticgreens.com/mindedmatter or click the link in the episode description. You'll get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D with your first purchase. And with that, here's my conversation with Professor Will De L'Artigue.
All right, Professor Will De L'Artigue, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me on.
Can you start off by just telling everyone a little bit about who you are and what your lab studies?
Sure. So I'm an associate member at Monell Chemical Senses Center, and I have an appointment at University of Pennsylvania in the Department of Neuroscience. And I guess my background, I study the neurobiology of feeding.
And so what I want to talk about today, basically, if I sort of what I'm envisioning here is the biology of feeding after food is swallowed and gets past the tongue. And so, you know, one of the interesting pieces of biology here is that the body can sense what we eat and how much we eat in various different ways. And so, you know, obviously everyone has experience eating food. We know that it has taste. We can taste sweet things and sour things and savory things. But there's some interesting biology and some interesting, you know, sensory biology that's happening after we swallow our food that allows our brain to know what we actually ate. And so to start off, can you just start talking about what are some of the major ways that the gut is communicating with the brain? You know, I know that there are nerves that are coming down from the brain to the gut. The gut is releasing hormones that circulate in the bloodstream and go back up to the brain. What are the basic kinds of ways that gut-brain communication happens?
Okay. Well, that's a very big topic right there. But essentially, food comes into the stomach, and the amount of food that we consume is sensed through the stretching of the stomach itself. And that information can be relayed to the brain in multiple different ways. The main way is that there's different nerves, like the vagus nerve, for example. That is probably the longest and biggest nerve in our body. It innervates all the different organs, and it highly innervates the stomach and the intestine. And so when these nerve terminals in the stomach feel the stomach expand as we get more full, that sensation triggers the vagus nerve and signals to the brain that, you know, there's food in the stomach. And it kind of gives us some information about the amount of food that we've consumed. And then the food kind of gets broken down and it gets into our intestines where it gets absorbed. And there's two things that happen. So the cells that line the intestine will release hormones as they sense the different types of nutrients. Those hormones can enter into the circulation and act directly on the brain, or they can act in a paracrine manner, which means that they're just being released from these cells and activating the nerves that are nearby. And then the vagus nerve can also signal to the brain that way. And then the intestine can send information about, again, stretch. So how much the quantity of food that's reaching the intestine, but also the different types of nutrients, so fats, sugars, proteins that are actually in the intestine as it's getting broken down and absorbed is also being sent to the brain. So there's a lot of information in response to a meal that gets processed at the level of the gut, and that gets sent to the brain.
So the nervous system can actually detect that something's in the stomach and the GI tract, and not only that, get information about what's in there before it's all those nutrients are even fully absorbed and circulating throughout the body.
Yeah. And it's thought that the stomach doesn't really process the types of food that we have, more the volume of food, and then the intestine probably does a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. And the combination of those informations then lead to different types of behavioral consequences. So when you feel stretch and you feel full, then it makes you stop eating. But when you sense the nutrients, that can maybe to some degree control food intake, but we think it's more dictating what types of food we want to eat and actually causing reward that might prolong the meal or increase the rate at which we're eating that meal.
Mm. So there's this mechanical sensation that happens starting in the stomach. So this thing called the vagus nerve is literally reaching down from the brain, and it's touching the stomach. Can we think about this at almost like, you know, the sensory neurons in our hands? Like if I go and grab something, I can feel it stretch or compress because I have sensory neurons that give me my sense of touch in my hand. Is it kind of like that, where we've got a nerve reaching down to the stomach and it's sort of wrapped around it and literally just feeling it physically?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite similar to that. It's something that allows us to sense what's going on internally as opposed to what's happening externally. Those two processes happen through different types of nerves, but the concepts and the ideas are, you know, they translate across both. And, you know, one thing I didn't mention, and I just want to clarify, the vagus nerve is probably the main one that innervates the stomach and the intestine, but there's also some evidence that the spine, the nerves from the spine, can also sense what's going on, their role, what they're doing, what types of information they're signaling. That's less clear. There's also some evidence that they might be conveying information about the volumes. So it's not just one nerve that's communicating all the information, but that vagus nerve seems to be the critical one.
Mm-hmm. And okay, so there's multiple, you know, nerves in the body that can do this type of internal sensation. The vagus nerve is a big one, literally. Yep. Can you talk a little bit more about the basics of the vagus nerve? Where in the brain are the cell bodies located? How many neurons are a part of this nerve bundle? And can you talk a little bit more about all of the places, you know, just give us a sense of like all of the places it goes. Is it just the stomach and intestines? Is it all throughout the body? Is it certain parts of the body?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the vagus nerve it's a nerve, right? It has two different components that are bundled within it. It has fibers that send information from peripheral organs to the brain. And then also separate nerves that are bundled in the same nerve that go from the brain down, and they control the function of those organs. The types of organs that are innervated are pretty much everything you can think of below the neck. So your heart, your lungs, and then below the diaphragm, the stomach and the intestine are probably the ones that are most heavily innervated by the vagus nerve. But there's a whole range of, I mean, you can think of pretty much every organ down there is probably the kidneys, the liver, the pancreas for sure. Other ones are more debated, but there's a lot of innervation. Probably the one thing that's not innervated by the vagus nerve is your fat cells. Hmm. So that's the one exception, but everything kind of below the diaphragm pretty much receives vagal innervation. And so because you've got both the sensory component that senses what's going on in the organs, sends information up. It sends a lot of different types of information, right? So if you think about the heart, for example, it sends information about blood pressure, heart rate. If you think about the lungs, it sends information about your breathing. And at the level of the GI tract, it sends information about the types and the quantity of foods that we're eating, but also some immune responses. If you're sick, all of that information also sent through by the vagus nerve. So there's a lot of information that's continuously being sensed and signaled to the brain via this nerve.
Mm-hmm. And okay, so we can think of the vagus nerve as being largely about sensing and controlling what the organs of the body are doing.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
And maybe let's define the term nerve here and give people a sense of, like, you know, is this one big neuron or is this thousands of neurons?
Yeah, right.
Like,
so yeah, you did ask that and I forgot to answer that. So there's so the cell bodies of the vagus nerve, the sensory component and the motor component, the ones that control the function from the brain down, are anatomically separated. They're located in different places. So the motor neurons, the ones that control the function of the organs from the brain, are located in the brain. They're actually in the hindbrain, the kind of a primitive region of the brain that's able to control the function of these organs. Then the cell bodies for the sensory neurons are actually located outside of the brain. So it's called the peripheral nervous system. It's found in a ganglia, which is just a fancy word for a bunch of cells that are in one, like all together in a tissue. And there's there's thousands of cells within ganglia. And the important part is that there's two different nerves that run parallel through our body that maybe have slightly different innervation patterns of different organs. But there's about 1,000 in each nodose ganglia in a mouse, and in a human, it's significantly larger, maybe 20,000. So there's a lot of these cells, and each cell can innervate a different organ and a different part of the organ. So almost like basically looking at one cell gives you information about one organ, one type of information from the organ, but you'd have to look at the totality to get the whole information that's being sent via the vagus nerve.
I see. So you've got this big nerve bundle, and if you were just to start randomly picking neurons, individual neurons out, you might have one that's talking just to the heart, another one that's talking just to the stomach, and so on.
Yeah, that's right.
And is it projecting elsewhere into the brain, or is this strictly talking, like, is it projecting to other parts of the brain, like cerebral cortex or the hypothalamus or anywhere else?
So not directly. So it terminates in the hindbrain. The vagus nerve starts in the organs, goes up, and then terminates in the hindbrain. But then those neurons in the hindbrain that receive the information project to lots of different regions in the brain. So information from the vagus nerve is actually received by the vast majority of the brain, and it's used in decision-making processes and memory and reward and all these different aspects that dictate how we behave. So that information that we get from the body is actually critical for everything that we do on a day-to-day basis, but the actual terminals themselves are in the hindbrain.
I see. Yeah, so it's communicating with virtually every part of the brain, but there's other neurons in between.
Right. So it's not a direct communication, but it's multisynaptic connections that allow for this communication throughout the whole brain. Correct.
And so, like you said, in the stomach, it's primarily this mechanical stretching stimulus that's being sensed by the vagus nerve. By the time we get down into the small intestine, there's also some sensing of individual nutrients and different things, fats, sugars, other things we might be ingesting. Can you talk a little bit more about that? What are all the types of nutrients that we know are being sensed? Is it basically every type of nutrient we can think of, or is it only certain select ones? What does that look like?
I would say almost every single nutrient can be sensed by the vagus nerve to some degree. The exact mechanisms and so this is all kind of, we're in the infancy of this field. We're learning as we go along. Right now, it looks like most things can be sensed by the vagus nerve to some degree. And by most things, I mean, yeah, the three major macronutrient types, fats, sugars, proteins, but also things like fibers that are not necessarily digested by the body. So then we're thinking probably bacterial products. So we've got a whole bunch of bacteria in the GI tract, and it looks like they can communicate with the vagus nerve. I mentioned that there's immune cells within the GI tract. And actually, that's not really surprising because if you think about it, the lumen of the GI tract is kind of the external world in many ways, right? It's directly connected to the outside world. And so you'd want to have a protective barrier and an immune system that is very active around where there's interplay between the outside world and the internal world. And
So if you've
so
got some kind of like gut inflammation and there's a bunch of immune cell activity, the vagus nerve can sense that's going on.
that can definitely be sensed. And then things like osmolarity. So, how many ions there are, and the pH can probably also be sensed. There's evidence that maybe water can be sensed as well. So the vagus nerve really senses just everything that's going on. It doesn't project into the lumen, so it's not directly sensing what's in the actual gut itself, but it's sensing there's information from the gut that's being communicated to the vagus nerve. So it's kind of an indirect communication. Or as things get absorbed, those things are then sensed. So it's really sensing what's entering into the body rather than what's in the actual gut per se.
And so, like, what happens? I imagine as people started studying the vagus nerve, you probably started with some pretty crude manipulations. Like, people might cut the vagus nerve or just sort of stimulate all of it all at once. As we were starting to do those experiments and just starting to learn what the vagus nerve was doing, what what do some of those results look like? What happens if you damage the vagus nerve, you know, entirely or mostly? What happens if you start stimulating it, you know, electrically or optogenetically or something like that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So we started off with more primitive tools. Vagotomies, which is just cutting the vagus nerve, was kind of essential and kind of a fundamental part of how we understand what the vagus nerve is doing. And there's a lot of caveats that I'll talk about in a second about how we interpret those data. But what we learned from those experiments, and essentially if you cut the vagus nerve above the diaphragm, the animals don't tend to survive those surgeries, especially if you cut both sides, because now you're no longer controlling your breathing rate and your cardiovascular response.
I see.
And so actually the animals tend to gasp and don't survive. So when we talk about vagotomies, what tends to be done is subdiaphragmatic vagotomies. So that's below the diaphragm. That's all the organs that are in our abdominal cavity. We can cut those. We can cut those bilaterally. And there what we see is an impairment in the size of the meal that we eat. So it's really having a very specific effect, very targeted effect on just manipulating how much we're eating at a specific meal without really having massive effects outside of that. So when you do these vagotomies, the animals, first of all, they're a bit sick. They struggle with this, right? So this isn't just something that you can do and then immediately record their behaviors afterwards. They need a little bit of time to recover from this. It's a harsh thing to do to an animal. It was done in humans as well for a while, actually, thinking about it, for certain treatments early on, specifically related to gastric issues. For cancers, I think they cut the vagus nerve. It seemed to help a little bit. So there are in the 70s, a lot of people were undergoing vagotomies for treatments of this type of disease. And even in those patients, it didn't really have massive effects. It impacted a little bit about how they ate, but not really very much else. And again, there's a lot of caveats to these types of experiments, because as I mentioned at the beginning, the vagus nerve is bundled and it has the motor component and as the sensory component. So when you cut the entire vagus, you're influencing not just the information that's going up to the brain, but also how the nutrients and how the organs are functioning. So how the nutrients are being processed, it impacts our ability to break down the nutrients, to absorb the nutrients. And so it's actually very hard to interpret what these, what the vagus nerve's role is in anything when you basically are impacting how the body is processing what you're studying as well, right? So since then, we've kind of refined the tools that we have at our disposal. We developed this approach that allows us to selectively target just the sensory component. And there we got like a little bit of a better idea of what the vagus nerve is doing. And recent experiments from my lab have demonstrated that essentially if you do this in lean animals. So these are animals that are just maintained on their normal chow diets. It influences meal patterns in kind of interesting ways. So before, when we cut the vagus nerve, we would see that it reduces the meal size. But here we were seeing that in addition to meal size, we were also getting effects on the duration from one meal to the next. So those two are thought of as different entities. One is called satiation, one is called satiety. And so when we were selectively impacting the information from the gut to the brain, then we were impacting both the satiation and the satiety, but it still didn't lead to these long lasting chronic effects on how much we eat over a 24 hour period, for example, until we give them access to things like a high fat diet or high sugar diets that really pushed the system a little bit further. And there the animals are no longer able to interpret that the meal has got the amount of calories that they've consumed is larger. And so they're not compensating by reducing their meals appropriately. And so what we're seeing in those animals, and now they're eating way more than the animals that don't have these deaffrontations.
I see. So there, if I'm hearing you correctly, there's a dissociation between like the total volume, total mass of food that's been consumed and the caloric density of whatever mass has been consumed.
Correct. So So the mechanical stretch that we were talking about earlier, that's the amount of food that we're consuming. The nutrients is thought of as calories. And so those two are kind of dissociable in terms of the neurons that are involved in the process. But also when you impair the entire ability of the vagus to sense what's going on in the gut and send that information to the brain, then you're impairing the animal's ability to sense that there's more calories, maybe more food, but really more calories. And therefore, they're not able to compensate by reducing appropriately the amount of food that they're eating. Because a normal animal, if you give it a high fat diet for just a couple of days, well, the first day it goes crazy for it because it's delicious and they really like it, right? But over the next few days, they regulate and they say, okay, well, there's more calories. So actually, I'm going to eat less total amount of food so that I eat the same number of calories.
Yeah, they're compensating.
The animals that don't have their vagus nerve that allows communication from the gut to the brain, they do not compensate.
I see. Interesting. Interesting. And there's all sorts of places this is going to connect to, because, you know, a lot of the stuff that we're interested in as humans has to do with our ability or inability to make various compensatory changes in our diet, given the food environment we live in. But, you know, one thing that I think is implicit in what you're saying is, so the vagus nerve can detect lots of different things. It's not just mechanical stretch and the amount of the mass of food that you've eaten. You've said that it can detect, say, like things like fats and sugar separately. I would imagine that what you're probably going to tell us is, if you look at individual neurons from the vagus, they're not all identical. So they are molecularly distinct. Some of them probably have sensory receptors that, you know, detect amino acids, some that detect glucose, and so on and so forth. Is that what's going on?
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on. And that was actually kind of both surprising and kind of nice to see. I mean, the reason it's surprising is, I said at the beginning, there's only about 1,000 neurons, maybe even fewer than that, within a single nodus ganglia.
In a mouse, right?
And so it's surprising that you can get that level of separation in terms of one neuron sensing one macronutrient. That was somewhat surprising to us, but that is exactly what we see. And so we do these experiments where we're recording the activity of these neurons. We're visually looking at the entire nodus ganglia, the entire area where the vagal sensory neurons are located. And we're recording the activity of these neurons. And we're seeing that when we give sugars, there's this population of neuron that's activated. And then when we give fat in the same animal, now a spatially separate population of neurons is being activated. And I mean, it's very clear cut. There's very little overlap between these two populations. And then, not in this paper, but we're carrying forward with proteins. And again, we're seeing similar things. And actually, what's interesting is when you get into the kind of more nitty gritty, it looks like these different populations of, even within the sugar sensing neuron, there's different neurons that sense different types of sugars, even at that level.
So yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I was going to ask you about. Like, how specific does it get?
I mean, it looks like it's very specific. And so the question is just one neuron sending very specific information to the brain, or is it more than one? The exact number of neurons that are involved in detecting, say, a specific type of sugar moiety, that's not clear. We're not, like I said, we're kind of still in the infancy of this field, but it does look like it's a lot of specificity is happening within these neurons.
It could very well be that level of specificity, like one neuron, one sugar molecule.
It could be.
And, you know, I'll let you direct us based on where there's more information and where we know more. But, okay, so we've got sugars, a type of carbohydrate. We've got fats, another macronutrient class. You know, I've been very interested in a while for how the body processes and responds to different specific fats and different specific sugars differently. So, you know, I'll let you guide us again, but, you know, for fats, right, you've got saturated fats, you've got long, medium, short chain ones, odd chain ones, even chain ones, et cetera, et cetera. You've got omega-3s, you've got omega-6s, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, different types of fat molecules. On the sugar side, right, you've got glucose, you've got fructose, you've got various non-caloric sweeteners that are meant as substitutes for those. You know, taking either class of macronutrients, what do we know about the response that the body has to different sugars, even when they are calorically equivalent, or different fats?
So what do we know? So I think at the level of vagus nerve, we don't know a lot. That's probably the truth. But we do know that, for example, glucose and fructose, which are the two sugar components that make up sucrose, that even these two fairly similar sugars actually have very profound differences in terms of how the body processes them and what the result of these two has on the body, both in terms of how we metabolize them, how the liver ends up dealing with that, and the consequences on insulin and energy production, but also how the brain processes that and then how we make decisions based on that. So like glucose, for example, is far more satiating than fructose, which is very surprising. We don't really understand why. Glucose is more reinforcing, more rewarding than fructose is.
Glucose is more reinforcing than fructose is?
Yeah. So by reinforcing, I mean, you're more likely to want to consume glucose. If you give an animal glucose, for example, directly into its gut, it's more likely to prefer that than if you infuse fructose directly into its gut. And if you pair a flavor with that, they'll learn the flavor for glucose faster, more efficiently than they will for fructose. And then at the end, if you give them the two flavors, they'll prefer the glucose flavor. So there's a lot of evidence that animals will prefer glucose over fructose. And in fact, if you give them in a bottle glucose and a bottle for fructose, they'll at the beginning, they like them maybe equally because they're both sweet. Maybe even like fructose a little bit better because it's sweeter. But over a number of trials, they'll almost exclusively drink glucose. So glucose is the preferred the preferred sugar in this case.
Is that true with humans? I had a conversation.
Yeah, so that's where it all gets a bit unclear. I don't know. I don't know is the answer. There's probably literature on this. I'm not familiar with it. So I don't know.
I see. Because I had a conversation with Robert Lustig, a physician scientist, and you know, one of the things he really emphasized was, and he's thinking more of human literature in his mind, but I'm not sure how much overlap there is here. He was basically saying fructose interacts with the addiction circuitry of the brain and glucose doesn't nearly as much.
Okay, well, so part of the reason for being here, right, is to discuss this paper that we've just published. And in there, we clearly show that sugars are driving reward. We didn't specifically test it in our paper, but there's lots of evidence, at least again, in the animal literature, that glucose is the one that's driving this reward circuit that we're identifying. So, you know, fructose can have some benefits, maybe in some other ways, but it's not engaging this gut-brain reward circuit in the same way that the glucose is. I think most of what I'm going to be talking about today is really driven by glucose rather than fructose.
Okay. Yeah. And so, yeah, let's get into that a little bit. So the vagus nerve, it's reaching down, it's touching and sensing information about almost all of our organs in the body, the stomach, the GI tract, et cetera, et cetera. You've got distinct neurons that are specialized to some extent to sense specific types of nutrients, specific sugars, specific fats, and so on and so forth. What did you look at in this recent paper where you were looking at neurons that detected fats versus sugars?
Yeah. So I guess the starting point for kind of the entire study was the observation that we're eating foods that are bad for us, right? We're eating lots of fats and lots of sugary foods. And we just wanted to understand why are we doing this when we know that they're bad for us? It's not like there's any secret out there that we shouldn't be eating fats and sugars. And yet, right, here we are eating them all the time. So what is it about fats and sugars that makes them so enticing, so rewarding that we want to eat them? And so that was kind of our starting point. And really, we kind of were thinking along the lines of, well, if we could understand the molecular mechanisms by which these different macronutrients are sensed, maybe it'll give us insights into why we're doing this. So that's kind of our starting point. And so when we, and I kind of taking a step back, I guess, we are also already previously identified a gut reward circuit. So we already knew that when nutrients enter into the gut, that when there's energy in the gut, that it activates a circuit that we'd identified that ends up with dopamine being released in the brain. So dopamine is this chemical that is a pleasure chemical, I guess, or motive. It increases motivation. There's debate about exactly what dopamine is, but essentially it's a measure of reward in some way. Mm-hmm. And we know that when nutrients enter into the gut, that it causes this dopamine release. And so the question was, well, do all macronutrients do this? Specifically, do the fats and sugar do this, given that we're so motivated to go and consume them?
Do all nutrients do this, or do they do it to the same extent? Presumably, right, commonsensically, you would imagine the things we like to eat more, like sugary foods, are going to result in a bigger dopamine spike in the reward centers of the brain.
Yeah, so that was our starting point. That's kind of what we knew already, and we came in thinking, well, there must be something different about fats and sugars that would make it worth studying them and understanding exactly what they do. And so when we did that first experiment that I've already kind of alluded to, where we were recording the activity of the neurons in the vagus nerve, and found that there was separate populations of fat and sugar neurons, that was really exciting to us, because it suggests, well, it's not just calories that are being sensed here. It's we're sensing at the macronutrient level. So that was the first kind of wow moment for us. And then we started wondering, well, what are these two different populations of neurons doing? And could we break it down and study them individually to figure out whether they play a role in reward? And so we use kind of a fancy tool. I don't know how much you want me to get into it, but essentially it allows us to selectively target the different populations, either the fat neurons or the sugar sensing neurons, and then genetically manipulate those populations. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think we need to go into details, but you know, people should know that you guys have the ability experimentally to use tricks from molecular biology to, you know, only look at, or only say activate or manipulate the sugar sensing ones, or only the fat sensing ones.
Yeah, exactly. So we're genetically tagging the neurons that are sugar sensing or fat sensing, and then it allows us to go in and manipulate them. Mm-hmm. And so I think probably the coolest experiment that we did is we selectively deleted the neurons that sense either sugar or the neurons that sense fat. And then we looked at the rewarding effects, or how the animal behaves as a consequence of that.
When you say deleted the neurons, do you mean you deleted the neurons' ability to detect that nutrient, or that you killed
them? They were gone. They were ablated. Yeah, okay. So we ablate either the sugar neurons or the fat neurons. I guess the first thing to note is the animals are fine. It has no effect on the animal. They behave normally. They don't really, there's no kind of odd behaviors that were observed. Except that when we did an experiment where, and this has been done a lot in the literature, where you essentially give the animals access to two different flavors. So in one bottle, you've got a novel flavor they've never had before, and then a different flavor in another bottle, and you give them a choice between these two flavors. You tend to like them equally. And then you associate one of those flavors with the infusion of the nutrient, be it sugar or fat, and the other flavor with water or saline. What happens over time is the animals become conditioned to like the flavor that's associated with the arrival of nutrients.
I see. And when you say infusion, you mean like putting it directly into the stomach?
Yeah, it's just basically just directly infused into there. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So they've got two bottles. They can go taste whatever is in each bottle. Yep. But then separately, you choose to or not put in some kind of nutrient directly into the stomach, and it's their ability to make that association we're talking about.
Right. So they're basically learning. It's very similar to Pavlovian conditioning that most people mm-hmm. are aware mm-hmm. of. It's that experiment with Pavlov's dog, where you ring the bell and you associate that the sound of the bell with the arrival of food. And if you do that enough times, just the sound of the bell causes the dog to salivate. It's a very similar concept to that, but here we're doing it with flavors and nutrients.
Yeah. And it's like, it's just, we take it for granted as living, breathing creatures, like, cause right, naturalistically we walk around and we eat things. We're always sort of making this association between the taste and whatever is actually in the food, because we swallow the food and that's just the way it works. But you guys can actually dissociate these things and manipulate them sort of one at a time.
Exactly. And yeah, you're right. It's happening all the time. We're learning every time we have a bite of something that whatever that taste is that we have is predicting calories. As we mm-hmm. get the calories in our gut, we then subsequently learn that flavor that was that we had in our on our tongue earlier actually predicted the arrival of the calories. And so actually we become really good at that. Subsequently, by just taking bites, we can kind of predict how many calories there are and whether it's something that we like or not. But I will also add that it goes beyond just taste, right? You're conditioned to the smell of things, the sight of things. Mm-hmm. If I show you a picture of cake, you're going to know that there's calories involved. And actually, you're probably going to like it and maybe even start salivating at the sight of it. So there's a whole, it's not just the
taste. It's a multimodal representation
to manipulate here.
Okay, so you kill these neurons, either the fat sensing ones or the sugar sensing ones, and it is disrupting this ability to make this kind of association.
Right. But what's really cool about the experiment, so if you delete the sugar neurons, the animal loses the ability to form a preference for the flavor that's associated with the infusion of sugar, but it does not impact the ability to form the preference for the flavor that's associated with fat. So it's very macronutrient specific in that way. You're deleting the sugar neurons. You're deleting the ability to form that sugar flavor preference, but not the fat flavor preference. And so that, I mean, to me, that was very shocking. That finding was just a wow moment.
And so you've got these labeled lines of information. It seems they're specific to different nutrients. Just for completion, I think. Based on what you said before, I'm assuming the sugar here was glucose. When you say you're giving them fat, what kind of fat are you giving them?
Yeah, so we're actually, the majority of the experiments in this paper was with sucrose.
Okay, so it's a mix of glucose and fructose.
And for the fat, we're using something called microlipid, which is just a mixed fat.
Okay, so it's going to have some combination of saturated and unsaturated
fatty acids. Yeah, I think so. I'm not actually 100% sure off the top of my head, but whatever microlipid is.
Yeah, I studied feeding behavior for 5 years. And I have to say, I have, so we use standard chow, we used high fat chow. I don't think I have a single memory in my mind of anyone ever talking about the specific macronutrient content beyond just knowing one was high fat.
Normally I look these things up, but I have to admit it's not on top of my head. So whatever's in microlipid is what we used here to represent basically fat.
Okay. And then, so talk a little bit more about, so you got these separate neural populations. One of them detects presence of sugars. One of them detects fats. You can kill either one of them and it disrupts the animal's ability to make associations with that specific macronutrient. How does this stuff tie in and hook into the dopamine reward system in the brain?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what we find is that as I mentioned earlier, if you give the nutrients into the gut, it'll cause dopamine release. What we went on to show is I'm not sure if this ended up making the paper or not, but anyway, what we have done in the lab is we've shown that if you remove the vagus nerve, then you lose the ability of dopamine to respond to the infusion of nutrients into the gut. So the vagus nerve is essential for this this connection between the nutrients arriving in the gut and then being communicated to cause dopamine release.
I see. So that would mean, so you put food directly in the gut, but the vagus nerve is cut. You don't get any kind of dopamine response in the brain. So there's no sort of reward response to the food, which means there's no other way to elicit that response. There's no parallel.
I mean, that's the interpretation. Yeah. That basically, if you don't have an intact vagus nerve, you don't have the ability to form the preference, the learning that is associated with the nutrients arriving via the dopamine.
And then, so when you measure reinforcement, like how do you measure reinforcement? How reinforcing is sugar versus high fat?
So the experiment that we did in this paper, so what I told you about before where we deleted them, that's kind of a necessity experiment. What you're talking about is sufficient, like how sufficient is it, right? Mm-hmm. And so to do that, we use another kind of trick in our tool belt where we're able to selectively activate the neurons. So we either activated the sugar neurons or the fat neurons, or we also took control animals where we infused them with saline and then activated the neurons that respond to saline, right? So we activated these three different populations. And what we were asking the animal to do is basically to put its nose in a hole. So it's kind of an arbitrary behavior that it doesn't necessarily want to do, that it has no incentive to do. But every time it does it in the right nose hole, it triggers the activation of these neurons. And so if it's something that is reinforcing, that it's rewarding, then they will perform this task. And if it's has no effect, then they probably won't even nose poke because they're not interested. And so when you do it in the control animals, that's exactly what you find. We have two nose holes. We have one that causes the laser to be activated and one that doesn't. And they will equally nose poke in both, and they don't nose poke very much at that. But when we have it so that we're targeting the neurons that sense either the sugar or the fat, the animals learn very quickly which one is the active nose hole, which one actually causes the triggering of this circuit, and they will do it a lot. So that was kind of our measure of that these neurons are actually reinforcing.
Mm-hmm. So you've got the detection of sugar, the detection of fat. Both of them can be stimulating either pathway can be reinforcing. Stimulating either pathway is going to give you a dopamine response up in the central nervous system, the classic dopamine reward circuitry. So if we sort of step back and think about the motivation for doing this kind of work that you were talking about earlier, you know, as humans, we live in this food environment where, you know, we've got cheap, easy access to virtually anything that we want. When we think of a classic junk food, the things that we know we all like to eat because they taste good, but are clearly bad for us, typically they're both high fat and high sugar. So in terms of the reinforcement in the behavior, in terms of the reward response in the brain, when you give an animal fat and sugar separately and fat and sugar together, what does all that stuff look like? Do these things stack on top of each other? Do they have some kind of interaction that's interesting here?
Yeah, so that's the key question, right? That's really where this was leading us to. We had essentially identified two different wiring diagrams, one for sugar, one for fat, that are separate. They run parallel to each other, but they don't cross over very much. And that happens at the level of the vagus. And I should say it also happens at the level of the brain. So if you look downstream to in the brain regions that then communicate to the dopamine producing neurons, mm-hmm. along that entire circuit, those things are largely separate.
I see. So it's just completely segregated or mostly segregated pathways for each nutrient.
Yeah. And so the implication is, well, if pathway sugar and pathway fat are separate, what happens when you have a food that has both together? Mm-hmm. And so we did a number of experiments. The first one was we gave animals access to either sugar or a water solution, sugar solution, a fat solution, or a fat plus sugar solution to lick. Gave them ad libitum access for 30 minutes, and we just quantified how much they consumed of it. And what's really interesting is, although we controlled for the number of calories, so everything has the same number of calories, the animals consumed nearly twice as much of the fat plus sugar combination than they did of either of the two solutions alone.
I see. So they will consume more of fat plus sugar than they will of either fat or either sugar, even when each choice has the exact same number of calories inside of it.
That's correct. Yeah. So that was the experiment that we did. And then, of course, there they were consuming orally. So there was an oral component. There was a taste component. We wanted to bypass that. So we repeated the experiment where they were licking for the exact same thing every time, but they were getting infusions into the gut of either the sugar or the fat or the fat plus sugar combination. And again, we got very similar patterns. They consumed pretty much twice as much of the fat plus sugar than they did of either macronutrient alone.
And you know, what do you think this means? What's the implication?
Well, it means that when we have foods that have the combination of fat plus sugar, that we're more motivated to go eat it and we'll eat more. So if you extrapolate further than that, I mean, that increases our susceptibility to develop obesity, and it could explain why we have seen huge rises in obesity rates in the last 50 years as we've manipulated our food environment more and more. So I think, you know, you look back before the 80s, 70s, obesity rates were around 15%. Now, today, right now, we're at 42% obesity rates. And that's obesity. I'm not talking about overweight. Overweight plus obesity is like 75% of the U.S. Mm-hmm. adult population. And it's thought that by 2030, 50%, like one out of every two adults is going to be obese. I mean, these numbers are just staggering, right? And And it's happened very quickly. In just 50 years, we've gone from 15% to nearly 50%. So what is it about this? What is driving this? Well, we think that the fact that we've created an environment where we have foods that increasingly are highly processed to have fats and sugars. And I think you can extrapolate beyond sugars. You could probably say carbohydrates as a whole. The mm-hmm. combination of fats plus carbohydrates is just something that increases our motivation. And just to reinforce that, what we've found, in addition to them consuming more, we found that there was significantly more dopamine being mm-hmm. released and more neurons in this whole circuit that are activated. So, you know, when you have foods that have the fats plus sugars, you're engaging these two separate wiring circuits for fats and sugars together simultaneously, and it's causing double the effect.
I see. So that was going to be my next question. How big is this effect? When you combine the fats and the sugars compared to either one alone, but you're holding calories constant, are you getting twice as much reinforcement, 50%
more?
Yeah,
so it depends on how you look at it. So in terms of reinforcement, so in terms of how much they're consuming, you're getting pretty much twice as much. When you look at the number of neurons that are active, we get more than twice. So it's more than just adding sugar plus fat together. It's super additive, right? And then when you look at dopamine release, well, we just compared one macronutrient to the combination. We didn't do the three. So it's hard to know exactly if it's additive or not, but it looked to me like it would be more than just the addition of the fat or the sugar alone.
So it's
very reinforcing.
Yeah, it's very reinforcing. And, you know, we start to think about like, you could imagine like why the system would evolve to strongly reinforce something like this, right? Right. You're trying to get an animal's body is trying to make sure it gets enough calories, which in naturalistic conditions are often very scarce to, you know, to survive and eventually reproduce. But we don't see like obese animals out in the wild. We see them in captivity. We see them in the city adjacent to when they're in our food environment that we've created. Do certain like macronutrient compositions just not exist out in nature, and we've just figured out that we can create them and that we like to eat them, and that's what's going on?
Yeah, I think you're hitting the nail on the head. So in nature, what we normally find is foods have a composition that is sugar or a composition that is fat. You rarely see things in nature that have a combination of both. And even when you do, like avocados, for example, it's, you know, skewed one way more than the other, right?
Yeah.
But most foods that you can think of that are natural are one or the other. And so it makes sense that we would evolve a system that would allow us to be reinforced to eat the foods that have the sugars because they exist in nature. And then the foods that are high in fat because they exist in nature and they're separate and they're probably going to be in separate places. And so we need, you know, when we were talking earlier about the learning about the taste and the sight and the smell of foods, well, how do animals go about finding their foods? They use all of these different senses to navigate their environment and they find where that food is. And then they remember, okay, well, all these cues say, this is where I'm going to find this food. So when they were looking for sugar foods, well, they had to remember where in their environment mm-hmm. it was located. They used all these cues and then they went back there. So it was an efficient way of being able to find the foods that you want, remembering where they were located and going back to the same place every time. So I think from an evolutionary standpoint, it makes sense that we would have evolved these two separate circuits. And what's happened now is we've created this kind of Frankenstein environment where we can control everything within it, which in many ways is beneficial to us because mm-hmm. now we don't have to worry about where am I going to find my food. I know I can just go to the supermarket. I can go to my fridge at home. Maybe even my drawer at work, like in my desk, I've got, you know, candy bars maybe. So I know where I can find food. I don't have to worry about that. And what we're left with is this one decision that we have to make of, well, what food should I eat, right? On a day-to-day basis, humans just have this one decision to make. When it comes to food, where am I going to eat? What am I going to eat? And we've made it so that we've created this food environment, like you've said, but really what we've done is we've created foods that are more likely to cause us to want to eat them. And it makes sense. I mean, if you think from a company's perspective,
right.
They're making foods. They don't want to make something that's bland that you don't want to eat, that's not reinforcing, that's not good.
Yeah.
You're not going to go buy it again.
Yeah, so they'll be put out of business by their competitor. Yeah. And so it's like no one architected this, you know, hundreds of years ago, just through trial and error and through the competitive, you know, market process, companies naturally converged on things that people would buy more. And, yeah, you know, in the absence of education, knowing like that things can be bad for you, and even in the presence of that education, very often people simply will eat the thing that they find tastiest, the most reinforcing.
I mean, and you know, how can you blame anyone for taking something that, and it's not just that it's tastiest. So I think another thing that to think about from this research is that it's tasty because mm-hmm. it activates this gut reward circuit, mm-hmm. right? So actually, if you think about it, the reason that we find things, that we find something tastes good, is because we've learned that it tastes good because it predicts the arrival of the calories. Mm-hmm. And in fact, as an example, kind of an extreme example, but you might really like pizza, right? Which has a lot of fats, has a lot of sugars. It's probably, most people are going to like the taste of it. But if I give you a pizza and it makes you sick, then actually, if I give you that same pizza the next day, I don't think you're going to eat it. Mm-hmm. You're going to figure out that this is an aversive thing. And I don't know, it might last forever. It might last a few days. Yeah. I don't know how that happens, right?
I mean, but a lot of people, I think, have experience with this. I can think of multiple examples in my life where someone I know eats something early in life and they never touch it again if they start right. puking afterwards.
So it can happen. It can be really strong. But sometimes you can kind of relearn and kind mm-hmm. of come back to it and say, okay, well, actually, I quite like this again. But it's all about the learning process, and it's all yeah. mediated by the gut. And I think that's kind of a key thing that was kind of an interesting takeaway from this, is that the reason that we're eating isn't because it tastes good. It's because of the calories that are in the food that reinforce that taste is good.
Mm-hmm. And those two things are very correlated.
Yes, of course. Yeah, they happen together. I mean, in nature, so we were able to dissociate the two experimentally.
Right.
But yeah, and in our day-to-day lives, then those two things kind of go hand in hand, of course.
What about, we've got an obesity epidemic, we've got a diabetes epidemic. You know, there's definitely some education awareness around, you know, added sugars at this point. Many people know that you probably shouldn't have too many added sugars to, you know, at least. And so some people at least are being more mindful of that. This has given rise to things like non-caloric artificial sweeteners, right? That don't have the calorie content, but do give you the tasty component that we enjoy. Is there anything interesting going on there in terms of the vagus nerve or the reinforcing effects and the rewarding effects that these sweet things have? Things like stevia, things like other artificial sweeteners that don't have the calorie content of glucose, but still taste sweet.
Yeah, that's a really great question. And actually, it's really interesting because these non-nutritive sweeteners tend to not activate the vagus nerve. So the vagus nerve is basically blind to these things. So it really activates the taste receptors on the tongue. It tastes sweet, but then when it gets to the gut, it's basically a wash. It doesn't do anything. And it doesn't cause the dopamine release either as a consequence of not activating the vagus nerve. And so if you kind of follow through with that logic, what is happening every time we taste a non-nutritive sweetener is we're now disconnecting the sweetness with calorie. And so it's actually messing up our prediction, our ability to make these predictions. So now next time when you eat something that is sweet and has calories, you're no longer as good at predicting how many calories are in that thing based on the sweetness. And actually that has really nasty consequences because it means you're going to eat, in probability, you're going to eat more of it because you just don't know that there's this many calories just based on the sweetness.
Yes, that's what I was going to ask is, okay, so the idea is if I'm eating a non-nutritive sweetener, it doesn't have caloric value, the vagus nerve is not detecting it and tapping into the dopamine reward system in the brain, it's actually causing my brain to sort of miscalibrate the association between how much calorie is in the caloric sweetener or the sugary substance. And so I might actually eat more of it later because the prediction is no longer as strong as to what its caloric content will be.
Yeah. That's the logic, you know, that probably needs to be tested in a lab setting, but that's kind of the thought process. Yeah, I think that's what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, it makes logical sense. Okay, so it hasn't been directly tested.
I don't think so. So there are some cool studies that are done in humans that show that there's a ideal level. So if your sweetness matches the calories, you're more likely to prefer that. And so I don't even know if this is published, but I've seen the data where people have tested Coke versus Pepsi. So Coke actually hits that sweet spot where it's just the right amount of sweetness for the number of calories, and Pepsi's is slightly off. And so actually when people do the Coke Pepsi challenge, people tend to prefer Coke. And we think that might be in part the reason for that. But actually, if you artificially in the lab, decouple the sweetness from the amount of calories that the, and these are humans, are receiving, they're really good at figuring out which one is the right one. And if you disconnect that, there's evidence that it might actually cause metabolic effects in the long run. So I think there is evidence to support what I said earlier. It's not just a wild speculation at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
But the actual direct evidence that if you chronically consume these non-nutritive sweeteners, that it'll make you overconsume the sugars. I think that's probably the bit where we need a little bit more evidence for.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it should be readily testable in rodents.
Absolutely testable. One. Absolutely.
Interesting. But that makes sense. Okay. So the non-nutritive sweeteners, you know, when you first started saying like, oh, they don't activate the reward circuitry in the same way, you know, naively you go, oh, that's good. But, you know, unless you're going to completely give up caloric sugars, which is effectively impossible, it could actually break your brain's ability to accurately assess, to tie the reward component to the calorie component.
Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting. Can you just, I actually don't know beyond like stevia and maybe one more, what are the major non-caloric sweeteners that are out there and how do they actually work?
That's not my area of expertise. So I don't want to kind of go too much into this, but they all activate the same receptors in the tongue that the T1R3 receptors that are give you the ability to taste sweetness. That's pretty much... Okay. Which is the same thing that the sugar, that caloric sugars do. So they activate the same sweet receptors on the tongue. But whereas glucose is taken up by a specific transporter in the gut, those do not take up the non-nutritive sweeteners.
Got it. I want to ask you a little bit about gut hormones as well. Okay. And how gut-brain communication is happening via that route. And there's two that I'm hoping that you can talk about a little bit. Let's start with leptin. So what is leptin? Where does it come from? And what is it? What's the basic explanation for what it does?
So leptin is a hormone that's released from adipose tissue, so from fat cells. Mm-hmm. The amount that is released is proportional to the amount of fat that you have. So the more fat you have, the more leptin you have. And it's thought to be kind of a long-term sensor of energy status. So it kind of doesn't necessarily fluctuate very much from meal to meal, but it does fluctuate as your body weight changes. And it's an important signal to kind of maintain your kind of body weight over a long period of time. So that's kind of mostly what leptin does, but there's also a pool of leptin that's released from the GI tract. And so that accounts for about 25% of the total leptin that's circulating at any time in your body. And that does fluctuate in response to a meal. So after a meal, you get more leptin released. And so actually, while leptin generally is thought to control your body weight, there is kind of an acute response in response to a meal that does control how much you eat. And it's possible that it works through different mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. And this is meant to signal satiety.
Oh yeah, sorry. Yeah, so in both cases, it controls how much you eat, or it's just satiety.
So more leptin means you would then eat less.
So that's mostly true. There's this weird kind of dichotomy that happens in obesity, where of course, I said, the more fat you have, the more leptin you have. And so actually it's kind of this reverse effect, where actually in obesity, although you have more leptin, you're less responsive to that leptin. So the ability of the cells to respond to the higher levels of leptin is impaired. And so in that sense, it's called leptin resistance. When you have leptin resistance, although you have more leptin, you're kind of insensitive to the effects of leptin. But yeah, in general, leptin equals satiety, in the exception being obesity.
So leptin resistance, your cells are no longer responding to leptin in the way that they're supposed to. Is there an analogy there with insulin resistance? Is it the same kind of phenomenon?
Yeah, I think it actually works in quite similar. The underlying there's lots of different ways that this is thought to happen. There's at the molecular level, the way that this happens are going to be slightly different, but overall, it's very similar. Yeah,
and can we think about these things, these metabolic issues, leptin resistance, insulin resistance? Are they like a drug addiction where it's like you've taken so much of a drug that your cells are no longer responding to it because they've either downregulated the receptors or the receptors have become insensitive or something? But is it, in essence, it's a response to too much of something? Yes.
Yeah, I think that's that's the way I understand it. So when leptin activates the receptor, there's this negative feedback loop that happens. And that's kind of traditional in most of physiology, right? You get feedback loops. And so what that means is that as there's more leptin and there's more signaling, then it also has some sort of inhibitor that's kind of built into the system so that it feeds back onto the receptor and essentially shuts it off. Mm-hmm. And so even though you've still got leptin present, then it doesn't really signal anymore. So what's thought to happen with leptin resistance is that feedback mechanism is kind of hyperactivated. And so you're kind of turning off the ability of the receptor to respond to something, even though you're not even responding to it in the first place.
I see. So if you've got a normal lean individual who's not leptin resistant, you would expect them to feel more satiated, more or less hungry when their leptin levels are higher. But if you had a obese person, especially if they'd been obese for a long time, if they were leptin resistant, you would actually see higher levels of leptin in them, even though they are eating more than the lean person.
Yeah, I think that made sense. I tuned out a bit, but just to be clear, when there's more leptin in the lean person, you're going to eat less.
Yes. Right. But if you're leptin resistant, you could actually have elevated leptin levels but
with no effect.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So there's this other gut hormone that people have been talking about a lot recently because of some of the new drugs that are out there, GLP-1. So what is that?
GLP-1's a fascinating drug. First of all, it's Ozempic and these other drugs that have GLP-1 activate on the GLP-1 receptors, and they're very effective at causing weight loss, reducing food intake, have a lot of these effects. But in the body, we have GLP-1 in two different places. One is in the gut. So there's specialized cells in the gut. They make up about 1% of the total cells in our gut, and they will release GLP-1 in response to the arrival of food in our intestines. So when there's food in the intestine, GLP-1 is released, gets into the circulation. It's not clear if it's working through the vagus nerve or if it goes into the circulation and acts directly on the brain, but it essentially causes you to eat less. The one thing about GLP-1 is, under normal conditions, your endogenous GLP-1 is very rapidly degraded. And so it's not, that's why it's not clear if it's actually effective at the level of the brain, but it'll definitely activate the vagus nerve. There's lots of GLP-1 receptors on the vagus nerve, and activation of GLP-1 receptor expressing neurons causes significant reduction of food intake. So this pathway gets activated when you eat a meal, triggers these GLP-1 receptor vagal neurons to tell the brain to stop eating. And then there's a separate population of GLP-1 producing cells in the brain. And they, when they're activated, usually in response to a very large meal, will also tell you to stop eating.
Okay. So this is a mechanism. Food gets into the intestine, GLP-1 is released, and it's causing you to eat less. So it's a way for the body to tell itself, hey, we've got food in the intestine. We don't need to eat as much in the near future.
Yeah, definitely at the level of the gut. And then at the level of the brain, it seems like that happens in very large meals. So when you're when you're at that point where you're feeling really, really full and maybe a little bit uncomfortable, that's when your GLP-1 in the brain is telling you, okay, you really need to stop eating now.
And so you said leptin gets released from fat cells. Did you say where GLP-1 gets released? What kind of cells?
Yeah, so it's cells either in the gut, these specialized cells in the gut, or this very unique population of cells in the brain.
In the brain. And then you said this other feature it has, it's very rapidly degraded. You know, that's a feature that various other signaling molecules have, and it's often a very important component of their temporal regulation. You only want the signal to be there for a certain amount of time. It sounds like the new drugs, like Ozempic, they are like GLP-1 in that they activate the GLP-1 receptor to drive less eating, but they are unlike it in the sense that they aren't as rapidly degraded. Why were they made that way, if you know, and do you think that we should be paying attention to that?
So that's a feature rather than a bug. I mean, that was the underlying reason for making these drugs, was to make them like GLP-1 but longer lasting. The idea was that GLP-1 is really effective at causing you to reduce your food intake, but it's so short-lived that if you give that in the body, you know, if you give that to somebody, it just wouldn't have a long enough effect. And so they extended the half-life of GLP-1 in the circulation. And with the latest version, the semaglutide Ozempic, you know, you only need to take it once a week. So it's really prolonging the half-life of the GLP-1.
Do you think that could pose a risk of these people developing GLP-1 resistance?
Yeah, so that's interesting because it doesn't look like that's what's happening. So like I said, usually in physiology, what you see is that there's these feedback loops and they turn themselves off. But it seems like maybe because the body has developed a system by which you don't need a feedback loop because it gets degraded quickly, maybe there's I don't know if this is true, but maybe this is why there doesn't seem to be a feedback loop. And so it allows for these longer lasting drugs to continue to have beneficial effects.
Mm-hmm. And is there any, it is clearly very effective at helping people lose weight. We've seen that already. Obviously, they did the trials to show that enabled it to achieve the success it has commercially. Any potential like downsides or things we should be looking out for in terms of this drug based on what you know about the basic biology here?
I'm not sure based on the biology, but from what I'm hearing, there's a few things that we need to kind of pay attention to that maybe people are not aware of. First of all, it's not effective in everyone. So it's talked about as this miracle drug, and yet that's because you only hear about the people in which it's working. They're the ones that are kind of telling everybody how effective it is on them. And you don't really hear people talking about it when it doesn't work, because they start probably because they're wondering, well, why isn't it working on me? I don't want to tell everybody that it's not working on me. So, you know, you don't really hear about the stories of it not working. There's some concerns about how the weight is lost. So it's very effective in weight loss on a whole, right? So I'm not talking about individuals. Some individuals it works great, some individuals it doesn't work at all, but as a whole, it's very effective. You get around 15 to 20% of weight loss. So like massive weight loss. But how that weight is coming off is kind of something that we need to be paying attention to. It doesn't look like it's all coming off in terms of your fat mass. It looks like there's some lean mass, some muscle mass, maybe even bone mass. So, you know, this is just something to pay attention to. I'm not saying that we know for sure that this is a problem, but it's something that we need to be paying attention to.
Yeah.
And then the kind of other thing that...
Actually, I'm sorry. Can you actually unpack that a little bit more? Why would we want to pay attention to it if you're losing muscle and or bone mass in addition to fat mass? Why is that an issue?
Yeah, I mean, then you're affecting your kind of... So if we're using it to treat obesity, what we want to do is get rid of the excess body weight. We don't want to get rid of our what makes us, you know, basically the part of our body that is burning off energy. We don't want to be affecting that. We want to, ideally what we'd want is a drug that just causes the fat to melt off without impacting anything else. And so here the concern is that it's impacting more than just the fat. And you know, if it causes you problems to gain muscle mass or to regain kind of your normal body tone, essentially, That could be problematic. Now, I'm not saying that that is what is happening. I'm saying that this is just something that we need to be paying attention to, because from what I'm seeing, it's not 100% fat mass loss. And then the other thing that I think that we need to be paying attention to with these drugs is that it seems to be impacting the reward system, which can be both good and bad, right? So it would be great, actually, if we could, as we talked about earlier, inhibit those fat and sugar reward systems so that when we eat them, we're not so motivated to go eat them again. But the problem here is that it seems to be globally reducing reward as a whole. So there's just a loss of hedonics. And in some cases, it's great. I've heard of people who were addicted to gambling, for example, for a very long time. They started going on these drugs and now they're no longer gambling anymore. So, I mean, so like these remarkable stories. Now, these are somewhat anecdotal. I don't want to make too much of a big deal out of this, but it does point to this idea that maybe it's kind of globally reducing our reward circuits. And the problem with that is if we don't have any reward, if nothing is rewarding and nothing is pleasurable anymore, then maybe it's not a great way to live.
Yeah. Well, I mean, do you remember the drug Rimonabant?
Right. Yes. So that's a CB1 receptor antagonist. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, just for the people that don't know, this was a similar story in essence. It was a weight loss drug. It was effective. It was approved in Europe. It acted through a different mechanism. It was a cannabinoid receptor antagonist. So it's kind of like THC gives you the munchies. It's sort of like the opposite. It's like an anti-THC type of drug. And it worked. The problem is it had this global sort of effect on reward, and people started getting depressed and even committing suicide.
Yeah. So I haven't heard anything about people committing suicide on Ozempic, but that would be the concern, right? That would be why you'd be paying attention to this, making sure that this isn't something that we have to worry about long term. But I think it, even if it doesn't cause depression, if it just reduces your ability to enjoy the day-to-day life, I mean,
right.
That's maybe a reason that people would no longer want to be on there. So there's that initial benefit of I lose all the weight, and then do I want to continue on this drug when I'm not getting other pleasures? Now you're having to balance, make that choice. And the problem is as soon as you come off the drug, you regain the weight. So it's something that you're either on pretty much forever or so that's kind of the problem that we have right now. If it's a forever drug, you're gonna have to take it every single day, or not every day, every week, and as soon as you come off of it, you're gonna regain it back. So
yeah, I mean, sort of the sort of future I can see emerging is, you know, there's like two populations of people that we're gonna see more and more of: those that self-regulate their behavior by shaping and controlling their own habits actively, and those that are basically just on drugs their entire life to mess with the outputs of the habits that they're not controlling.
Yeah, although I want to push back on that a little bit. I mean, you're kind of right that there's certainly a drug versus no drug approach, and both are different approaches. The problem with all of this is that this gut to brain circuit that I was talking about that causes this reinforcement that makes you eat more, it's all subconscious. It's not something that you're controlling, right? You have no control over this. How nutrients activate the dopamine, that is below your level of detection. You don't even know.
Yes, but I mean, but if you have all the knowledge that you just gave us, you do have the ability to control what you purchase, at least to some extent.
You absolutely,
I mean, people do it.
So there's a component of decision making there, but when you get this reward, it's not a one-off. It's not that in the moment you're eating it and it makes you eat more in the moment. It actually guides your future decision-making as well. And so next time when you see something that triggers this memory of, oh, I'm going to get calories if I eat this, and it's something that I want and it's pleasurable, then while you can consciously make the decision, okay, I'm not going to eat this, this is not what I want, the problem is when we start getting in condition in situations where in our daily lives, where we're stressed, where we don't have that much, you know, we're not paying attention to these types of decisions every minute of the day. And as soon as we turn that off, we're not consciously aware of this anymore, then we suddenly find ourselves reaching for that donut or whatever. And so I agree with you to a certain degree. Like, we need to be paying attention to these things, but I think we can't undermine the fact that there is a subconscious component to this that's really undermining our ability to.
Yes, I think what you're saying is the biology here tells us that, to some extent, potentially to a very large extent, it is going to be very difficult for a lot of people to will themselves into, you know, the behavioral place they want to be, because all of this stuff is happening at the level of things like the vagus nerve, and a lot of it is not subject to direct conscious control. We are, to some extent, slaves of our environment.
Yeah, exactly. And beyond that, like, our environment isn't just these foods that have these mixes of fats and sugars, but our environment is also the constantly being inundated by all these food cues. And by that, I mean, like, we see logos of different restaurants, for example. We see packaging. When we go to the supermarket, even, they put certain foods in certain places so that we're more likely to go grab them, right? So all of this is part of our food environment, and all of this triggers us to go and pick these up, to consume these at a subconscious level. And so that's where it's so difficult. That's where all this is just basically our whole environment is working against us to making the right decisions.
Mm-hmm. You know, thinking about all of this stuff and doing the research that you do, I mean, has it affected the way that you operate your own life when it comes to food?
You know, it has to some degree. I certainly am more aware of what I'm doing. I pay attention to what it is that I'm eating, what is in the foods that we're eating, where I eat, what I eat. So it definitely has played a role. It's not working great. I mean, I still, you know, eat bad foods all the time. So it's not preventing me from enjoying certain things, but I'm very mindful about not doing it all the time and paying attention to when I have certain cravings, that what that means. And really, it's just my gut kind of reinforcing these actions. And really, I can fight back against that. So actually, the knowledge is helping me control my urges to some degree.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that the lab is working on right now? Some of the big questions that you guys think you're going to have interesting answers to in the next few years?
So there's a bunch of stuff that we're working on right now. The two that I'm super excited about is, on the one hand, we're looking at how information is processed at the level of the gut. So I told you that there's the ability to sense stretch and the ability to sense, let's say, nutrients. Well, how does it do that? So we said that there's different cells that are doing this, but are they organized in certain ways that allows us to separate them out? And so what I'm really excited about is this idea about the left vagus nerve and the right vagus nerve might be actually signaling different types of information that might be controlling our behaviors in different ways. So that's one concept that I'm really excited about that hopefully will come out soon. And the other one is, we've talked a lot about reward today, but the other thing that we're interested in is about memory formation and you know, everything that we do around food has some sort of memory that's associated with it. Like I can eat something and it triggers memories from when I was a kid, or there's certain foods that might relate back to, you know, this one time I remember doing this. And so there's very deep memories that are formed around food. And so how does that happen and what does that mean is another aspect that we're really interested in.
All right. Well, this was fascinating stuff. All these gut brain communication things, I think are super interesting. And obviously it has a lot of implications for, you know, for stuff that people care about, and, you know, how we interact with our food environment. So I'm definitely interested to see what you guys come up with, coming down the line. Is there anything you want to reiterate or repeat or say again or emphasize based on, anything that we talked about?
No, I mean, I guess the take-home message from this study was that there's two different pathways for sugars and fat, that when they are combined together in response to foods that have both the fats and the sugars, that it increases our reward and that causes us to be more motivated to go eat those foods. And so I guess kind of the take-home message that the thought to be left with is, while we don't have ways right now of dealing with that, how do we kind of interfere with this system to prevent it? Just knowing about it can be helpful, mm-hmm. In terms of altering our behaviors. Mm-hmm. But also I kind of my longer term plan here is to try and figure out what it is that these neurons are. What are they doing? How do we, like, what receptors do they express? Can we develop drugs that specifically impair fat versus sugar reward so that we're less motivated? That just makes our life a little bit easier. So not these drugs like Ozempic that cause us to lose weight, but drugs that just help us with our willpower to improve our ability to go about our daily lives without going and reaching for that donut.
Yeah. I think what you're saying is, in principle, if there was a medication that you could develop that, based on the molecular distinctions between these different sensory neurons, those that detect, say, fats versus sugars, if you could selectively inhibit just those vagal neurons, you would be interfering with a person's ability to sense and therefore develop a craving to just that nutrient without interfering with reward processing, generally speaking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's kind of what we would love to be able to do, and it would just make our lives easier, right? We could walk around, still do what we will want to do, still eat what we want to eat, but now we're not grabbing for things subconsciously.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, you know, based on everything you told us, do you think it's worth just having in mind that? So you told us about this effect where if you combine fats and sugars, you know, you get more eating and more food addiction, basically, than if you had calorically equivalent amounts of either one. Just knowing that, is it worth people just thinking about, like, hey, if I want to have a snack, I've got one that's got fats and sugars, I've got one that's mostly carbs, I got one that's mostly fats. Maybe choose one that's mostly fats or mostly carbs rather than the one that has both.
Yeah, if you can, that would be great. It's difficult to do, right? Because when you think about a snack, can mm-hmm. you name a single snack, except for very healthy ones, that are not a combination of the two? I mean, I'm struggling right now to think of what that would really look like. So you could go and eat a piece of cheese, or you could eat a fruit, right? But it would be hard to think of a pure snack that you could get in a bag that you could buy from the supermarket that would just be one or the other. So I totally agree with what you're saying. I just don't know how easy that is in practice.
I don't think it's easy. I do it, but I don't think the things I consider snacks, I've had to train myself to relearn what a snack is and isn't.
Exactly. Right. That's key. If you can find a snack that would be just one or the other that you would consider a snack for yourself, that's perfect. That's exactly what you want to be doing.
All right. Well, Dr. Will De Lartigue, thanks again for joining me. This was fascinating, and have a good day.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.